Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Hello and welcome to the Hagman Report for Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. My name is Peter Barry Chalkin. I'm guest hosting the program today for Doug Hagman. Doug is feeling a little under the weather, but the worst part is that he has laryngitis, and you can hardly host a talk show when you have that. So he's asked me to fill in for him today and presumably for tomorrow, Wednesday, May 5th. Some of you may remember me from my many appearances as both a guest and a guest host on this program in the past. I'm an investigative journalist, a medical political analyst, and an occasional broadcaster. I write a lot for AmericanThinker.com, and I also appear in the media during the past year on John B. Wells' programs, often including guest hosting his Saturday night nationally syndicated terrestrial radio show, Arc Midnight. I've also done videos with Jamie Glassoff, and I've been a guest on Fox News, One America News Network, and the BBC. In the first hour of the program today, I'll be sharing some reporting I've been doing in recent weeks on issues that affect us all, and also, as I try to do, to broaden the discussion, looking between the lines at the real story with respect for the history that I've experienced and reported for over 57 years now. And when people hear me say that I've been at it for 57 years, many of them comment something like, "Peter, you don't look that old to have been at it that long." Well, it's amazing what you can do with makeup, lighting, and soft focus video. But seriously, I did start when I was very young, just entering high school. And that year, I was able to cover very close up some major events and personalities, including former Vice President Richard Nixon, Pennsylvania Rhino Governor Bill Scranton, who became a major national figure that year, 1964, when he tried to stop the nomination of conservative Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater for the 1964 Republican presidential nomination. And the real standout experience for me in that first year of reporting was when I covered a speech by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. that took place on November 30th, 1964. He spoke at a standing room only event in a nearby city, and I showed up that night with a camera, a microphone, and a reel-to-reel tape recorder. I was able to put my microphone on the podium that he spoke from, and in fact, I still have that microphone, and it amazes me when I look at it to think that it was about a foot or two away from MLK when he addressed the crowd that night. And because my microphone cable was short, I was allowed to sit right behind Martin Luther King, sitting on the stage behind him, operating my recorder as he spoke, maybe 10 feet away from him. And that night he delivered a version of his famous "I Have a Dream" speech that he gave at the March on Washington at the Lincoln Memorial 15 months earlier. And I heard him say that night, November 30th, 1964, and I captured it on tape, the words, to paraphrase, that he looked forward to the day when a man would be judged by the content of his character and not by the color of his skin. And I think we can all agree that that's something that is an admirable statement that captures the American spirit. But today, of course, his words, those words in particular, and his hopes have been turned upside down. By the way, in the second hour tonight, my scheduled guest is the great Diana West. I interviewed her twice here in 2018, shortly before the midterm election in November of 2018, and then afterwards. And she's been on the Hagman Report with Doug as well in the past. Diana West is one of our country's best and most courageous journalists and authors. She's helped to uncover the deep penetration of communism into our country going back about 100 years. And she'll be talking with me in the next hour about her latest work on the 2020 election and the COVID-19 pandemic, or plandemic, as many of us call it. Now, I'd like to start my reporting in this hour with a review of an article that I wrote for American Thinker 8 days ago now. It was published on Monday, April 26, 2021, and it's called Medical Racism, Preferential Treatment for Blacks Over Whites. Here. That article is still on the homepage at AmericanThinker.com right now. It's in the left-hand column under the date April 26th, and it will be there on the homepage for another 2 or 3 days, and then it will scroll off into the archives. But if you're accessing this program sometime after its broadcast date, you can continue to access that article by going to my webpage at peter.media. You simply enter peter.media into your web browser or phone. It will take you to my page, and there's a link there to my complete archive of articles at American Thinker. There are over 300 of them, and they can all be read for free, including the most recent one on medical racism. And it's an article that I spent a number of weeks researching and writing, and it's over 2,600 words. So I would really appreciate, if you're interested in the subject that I'm going to be talking about here, that you would take a look at that article. Now, it was extremely painful for me to have to write that article to begin with, considering where I started my reporting, covering people like MLK, who believed in equality of opportunity and not equity or racial superiority. So let's take a look at that article on the new medical racism. Race has always been used by the left, the Democrats, the Marxists, to divide us, and now more than ever. We've seen this all too clearly in recent weeks, and the strategy has now reached critical mass. And what my article details is how this strategy has now moved into the largest sector of our lives and the largest sector of the economy, that is healthcare. Healthcare in total is costing the American people and the American government over $4 trillion a year now. That's about 20% or more of the entire gross national product, and more than half of that bill is being paid for by the federal government, which of course is exerting more and more power on healthcare. Now, incredibly, this new racism might come to impinge on the very survival of some of us who are now considered to be the wrong color. Now, I've been reporting on healthcare since the 1970s, and in many of my appearances here on the Hagman Report, going back to 2017, I've talked about that. Healthcare has always been an area rife with politics, but I never thought I'd live to see anything like what's going on now. In early April this year, I became aware of a shocking new example of overt racism that proposes to remake healthcare on the basis of critical race theory. On April 10th, 2021, the prestigious medical journal The Lancet, which is one of the most prominent medical journals in the world, in fact, it's considered the number two most impactful medical journal in the world. So this journal, The Lancet, published an article titled, quote, "Racism is the public health crisis," end quote. The most important health crisis. I guess they consider it even more significant than COVID-19. Well, this is just the latest article on this absurd kind of claim that's been published by this journal and other leading journals. And the Lancet article praises Black Lives Matter. And before the verdict was in, the journal article said that the police, quote, killed, unquote, George Floyd. The article in this medical journal concludes like this. This is a direct quote. Racism is a defining feature of Western countries. The hierarchy of white supremacy creates an uneven distribution of resources and means that the majority of those who are not white are subject to various health inequalities. Structured racism produces racialized health outcomes. To make black lives matter, we need to understand that racism is the public health crisis. End quote. Again, this is a medical scientific journal. Incredible. Now, this is not an isolated screed issuing from an irrelevant academic ivory tower. 2 weeks earlier, an influential intellectual publication called the Boston Review published a lengthy article by two medical doctors, both of whom are also Harvard Medical School professors. It was titled An Anti-Racist Agenda for Medicine. The authors wrote that we need to rethink the nature of the fight for racial justice in medicine. And what's their prescription? Quote, offering preferential care to patients based on race or ethnicity, end quote. That is preferential care to black and Latinx patients. And of course, they're all using the term Latinx now instead of Latino or Latina. Now, the authors write further that they hope that their plans, quote, will get the backing provided by recent White House executive orders, end quote. And they then link to one of these Biden executive orders, which is thoroughly woke and reflecting critical race theory. Now, you might wonder, is all of this just theoretical or is it going into clinical practice? Well, last month it was also reported that this policy of giving preferential medical treatment to blacks and Latinx patients over whites is going into practice at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. That place is affiliated with the Harvard University Medical School, and it's considered one of the best hospitals in the country, if you believe in conventional medicine. It's part of the hospital's United Against Racism campaign. It was reported that the hospital would begin taking steps to prioritize patients for care based on their skin color. National Public Radio reported approvingly, of course, about this development. And here's what they said about it in an article and also in a broadcast. Quote, the plan is a response to anger, frustration, and calls for change within the hospitals that were heard following the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others. Employees shared their reactions and ideas in small discussion groups, hospital town halls, petitions, employee surveys, and protests, end quote. Well, when I read that, it reminded me of the statement, the old statement, the inmates are now taking over the asylum. In an article on April 8th, The Federalist, which is one of the few publications to cover any of this, described this shocking development. Their article said, one of the programs proposed in this race theory applied to medicine at this hospital, one of the programs proposed is something called redress. The program is intended to discriminate against whites who require medical attention so other individuals can automatically be given treatment, meaning other individuals of color. Now, the only mainstream reporting on this was a segment on Tucker Carlson's Fox News program on Tuesday, April 13th, I believe it was. And other than his show and the Federalist article and a handful of others, and of course my article, American Thinker, this has gone pretty much unreported. Now, the Tucker Carlson report on this was a typical 3 or 4 minute segment involved in his interview with a professor at DePaul University named Jason Hill, PhD, who is black. And he shared the news about these developments on Tucker. He called the scheme, that is, Professor Hill called this scheme that's going down in Boston and actually nationally, he called it political eugenics in the medical field, that's using a reparations framework to advance critical race theory. It's racist, Professor Hill said. It's using healthcare to advance the socialist system. He said it very, very well. And I've been in touch with Professor Hill since then. I quoted him in my article at American Thinker, and he sent me a very nice and friendly email in response. Now, Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, the one I've been talking about here, has since this minor criticism has emerged, probably Tucker's show, they have since published an undated page at their website denying that they are instituting racial preferences. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously, even considering or theorizing such a policy, it flies in the face of what Martin Luther King said, you know, that he hoped that, well, here's exactly his quote on the Mall on August 28th, 1963, the March on Washington, and MLK said, quote, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin and but by the content of their character," end quote. Now, Dr. King, of course, or Reverend King, I should say, was not perfect. I did some reporting here 2 years ago on the work of David Garrow, who was the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the major biography of Martin Luther King in the 1980s. And he uncovered what he reported was very damaging evidence about what MLK had been involved with. But, you know, no one's perfect, and I don't think it cancels out, so to speak, what Martin Luther King did with his life when he was on the planet until he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. You know, he was a man of God. He was a reverend with a real church and a real flock. And the civil rights movement was kind of an outgrowth in many ways of Christianity and was led by many Christians, including King in the 1960s. And compared to what's come since then, I will take a Martin Luther King any day over most of the self-anointed black leaders today. Now, this insane theory of racial preferences in medicine, or the application of critical race theory to the medical industry, has actually popped up on the other coast as well, the left coast. And here's a recent example. Seattle conservative talk station KTTH reported in an article titled thusly, "The Washington State Department of Health lets providers deny vaccines to white people in a race exclusionary system that they claim creates equity and removes barriers." Now, I'm going to quote from this article because it's truly mind-boggling. Here we go. The African American Reach and Teach Health Ministry, the acronym is AARTH, is a vaccine provider in Washington State. Eligible participants can sign up for vaccines using their online scheduler. But if you're white, you're not able to access any open vaccine appointments. By default, white people are put on a standby list, one of two lists segregated by race for vaccine access. They will only provide their online appointments, that is this AARTH group, they will only provide their online appointments to people of color. If you're a person of color, you can move forward and schedule a vaccine appointment if there is an opening. But if you're white, you're automatically placed on a standby list. That bars you from continuing the process. AARTH says they will contact the white person if there is an opening. This policy effectively bars white people from accessing taxpayer-funded vaccines set up through the state. Under the current process, an older white person with obesity and cancer is at a higher risk than a young and healthy black person, yet the white Washingtonian would be denied access based exclusively on his skin color. Why? Because according to Frangie Mays, the Washington Department of Health spokesperson, quote, "Dealing with racism is a stressor that is bad for health and life expectancy," end quote. So that's the end of that significant quote from KTTH in Seattle. Now, it turns out that this attitude, that the practice of medicine is racist, is pervasive. An article in Time magazine 2 weeks ago by four esteemed authors claimed that there aren't enough medical journal articles about how medicine is racist. It turns out that the authors of this Time magazine article also authored an article in a leading medical journal, a peer-reviewed medical journal, in which they claimed in this journal article that only 1% of 200,000 articles that they surveyed that were published in the four leading medical journals in recent decades, only 1% were about racism. Well, that's still about 2,000 articles, but it's not enough for their view. I guess they think now that every other article in the medical journal should be about racism, since they all claim now that that is the most important health issue. Now, The Lancet, the number two journal in the world that I mentioned earlier, has appointed two far-left American MDs named Himmelstein and his wife Woolhandler to direct their coverage of racism in the publication. And I've been familiar with these two MDs for at least 25 years now. They are far-left advocates of single-payer, government-run, socialized medicine. And they've been at it their entire careers. They're getting up there in years now, but they are still pushing this. And they feel, and apparently they might be correct in this, that they're finally hitting pay dirt. It's another thing I never thought I would live to see, that these two fringe characters, basically. I mean, they were at Harvard University for quite some time. Now they've left there, and I believe they're at City University of New York, still working together. But almost everything they publish is a push for single-payer, socialized, and we might say Marxist medicine. Now, some of the recent articles in the Lancet journal that they are responsible for, here's the title of one of them: Recovering from Trump, Biden's First 100 Days. This is in a medical journal. The article, of course, attacks President Trump for all his usually attributed negative things, almost all of which are completely made up. And it praises Biden's first 100 days in not only healthcare, but everything. Now, earlier, a few weeks earlier, this journal, with these two, Woolhandler and Himmelstein, listed as the lead authors, they published a 49-page long article titled "Public Policy and Health in the Trump Era." Now, by then, the Trump era had ended. They published it after Biden was inaugurated, but they're still kicking a dead horse here. Now, that 49-page article claims that President Trump was a racist, anti-Semitic, anti-LGBTQ, anti-immigrant, etc., etc. And again, it's mind-boggling to think that this is published in a leading scientific medical journal. Now, as a journalist who covered the politics of healthcare and promising innovative alternative therapies for much of my career going back to the 1970s, I've long looked askance at the leading medical journals. But back in the day, it was a case of them largely ignoring innovative alternative medicine and or occasionally dismissing prominent innovative therapies when they did rise. For example, vitamin C and the work of the late Dr. Linus Pauling, the two-time Nobel Prize winner, who later in his career proposed that vitamin C and antioxidants and orthomolecular medicine, which he co-founded with Dr. Abraham Hoffer, MD, PhD, that these natural methods had the potential of great benefit for preventing disease and possibly for successfully treating disease, including cancer. But despite Dr. Pauling's incredible credentials, two unshared Nobel Prizes, the only two unshared Nobel Prizes in history, and a publication called The New Scientist put Pauling on their list of the 20 most significant scientists in the history of Western medicine. This happened in 1975 in their publication. You know, on this list were people like Madame Curie, Isaac Newton, Einstein, and Pauling was on that list. But once he got involved with the field of nutritional medicine, orthomolecular medicine, there were a number of studies published in these leading journals which poo-pooed his claims. And I actually got to know Dr. Pauling pretty well, and I interviewed him over a dozen times in the last 12 or 13 years of his life, 14 years of his life, including the last interview he ever gave when I was hosting a radio program in San Diego, and he came on there by phone 4 months before he died. It was just incredible to get to know that man and his brilliance and his humanitarian orientation. But that's what the medical journals were doing back then in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Now, they are even worse. They are fully on the bandwagon, apparently, of this critical race theory, and it's going largely unreported and unnoticed in light of all the other news that is hurled at us every day, the full-spectrum assault of negative news where you can't even believe what's happening when you check in with your news feed every day or several times a day, looking in vain for stories that suggest that there's some ray of hope out there, because it just is so bleak. Now, the Biden administration, of course, is deeply involved, invested in all of this. Last November, I wrote about, this was shortly after the mainstream anointed Biden as the victor in the November 3rd election, which happened, I believe, the Saturday after November 3rd. Well, a few days later, I wrote about one of Biden's first acts after he was declared the winner, his appointment of a COVID-19 advisory panel. And the second panel co-chair is a woman named Marcella Nunez Smith, MD. She grew up in the Virgin Islands and is now a physician at the Yale University School of Medicine, where she holds a variety of titles. Dr. Nunez Smith specializes in race and healthcare, and she studies medicine through the prism of race, social justice, and identity politics. Now, when I read about her and some of the other members of this panel, again, it was shocking. You know, we've been told by the Democrats, oh, President Trump and his administration did not follow the science. And yet, look at the people Biden is appointing to these scientific positions. I mean, of course, Anthony Fauci is now back as his number one advisor, and I think it's long past the point where he should have retired at age 80 now and enjoy the last, hopefully, long years of retirement. And here's another thing. The day after Biden was inaugurated, on January 21st, 2021, his administration issued a 200-page COVID-19 plan. 200 pages. So obviously, this document had been in the works for some time, maybe even before the election. It certainly read like that. And reading it, one should be surprised, if not shocked, at the proliferation of the language throughout about equity, racism, and how every government agency, not only in the healthcare sector, which is huge, but every government agency must now prioritize not equality of opportunity, but racial equity. Now, this, of course, entails reverse discrimination against white people. You know, also, I find it interesting that white people are not considered people of color. I mean, they have a color. It's white, or it's lighter than the other people of so-called color, right? So previous examples of this kind of reverse discrimination against whites included, starting back in the 1960s, the late 60s, affirmative action, preferential hiring, racial quotas, including in educational, acceptance at colleges, and the proliferation of government regulations and huge bureaucracies to ensure not only equality, but now equity in disparate areas of life. Now, they are increasing in number now that the Democrats have attained total control of the federal and of many state governments, not to mention other centers of American life, including academia, K-12 public and private schools, popular culture, sports, and even the largest corporations, which are showing that they are now fully woke. Now, here's several recent, in my opinion, obnoxious examples of this. In Oregon last December, there was a $62 million fund called the Oregon Cares State Fund, which steered coronavirus relief money directly to black Oregonians and black-owned businesses, and not to businesses owned by whites. As the Oregonian newspaper noted, quote, the application for funds explicitly stated that the money was meant only for black Oregonians, end quote. Of course, that publication, which is thoroughly woke, had no problem with that. Here's another example. The recently passed COVID-19 stimulus, several trillion dollars worth, included something called the Emergency Relief for Farmers of Color Act. That was introduced into the legislation by Socialist Senator Raphael Warnock, who won the runoff election on January 3rd this year for the Senate seat, one of the two Senate seats from Georgia, thereby shifting control of the U.S. Senate to the Democrats. Now, Warnock's act provides $4 billion for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to forgive direct or guaranteed loans given to farmers of color. Another $1 billion is going to the USDA, that is the Agriculture Department, for farmer grants, college scholarships, and other efforts for minority growers. And then another example, as I've already mentioned, is Biden's 200-page COVID-19 plan published on January 21st. And I really doubt that many people are even aware of or certainly read that 200-page plan. It's basically dense and unreadable, but it is significant. As I said, it's filled with references to race and equality, equity, and the need to consider, quote, redress or redress in virtually every federal department and program from now on. And at the same time, one of Biden's, almost 100 executive orders now, or maybe he's topped 100, one of his first executive orders issued in January was to establish a COVID-19 health equity task force at the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, back in the 60s, and I remember this because I was aware and alert then and interested in reporting on the news, even if it was initially from my high school newspaper. I remember this. The aim of the original civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s was equality, equality of opportunity, which obviously did not exist across the board in many areas of the country, including in what they call the Jim Crow South. Now, the legacy of that bipartisan Christian-based effort has now morphed into a twisted new movement that's not about equality of opportunity at all, but instead guaranteed equal outcomes or equity involving preferential treatment and the other things I mentioned, affirmative action, quotas, set-asides, etc., etc. Now, last year, a lawsuit in federal court alleged that Harvard University was accepting Asian American students at a lower rate than other racial groups, while giving preference to Black and Hispanic students with lower grades. Now, that's pretty much true. The Ivy League schools have pretty much admitted that, but the suit was dismissed in federal court. And meanwhile, critical race theory, the basis of wokeness and its introduction into healthcare policy, now totally dominates academia, and it's moved into public schools and also the corporate sector. So this is an item of deep concern. And by the way, just for the record, some critics on the left, immediately when you open the door to talking about any of this, they say, well, the reporter or the speaker or the analyst is obviously racist. Well, I'd like to note this fact. My primary sources in this area rely heavily, and I mean heavily, on intellectuals and people of attainment and achievement, including Shelby Steele, the author of a really important book called White Guilt, Thomas Sowell, Bob Woodson, and a relative newcomer, Candace Owens. And there are also several impressive new Republican members of Congress who are saying some really good things about these and other issues, including Representatives Byron Donalds of Florida and Burgess Owens of Utah. And by the way, all of these people I've just mentioned are Black. So I rest my case. It's not a racist analysis unless they are somehow racist. Now, I've been following, as I'm sure many of you have, the case of the former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin and his recently completed trial for the murder of George Floyd. And what can be said there? It obviously, in my opinion, was a kangaroo court. Even esteemed experts like legal authority Professor Alan Dershowitz has said that the trial should have been moved out of Minneapolis, where the threat of riots was occurring if the verdict went, quote, the wrong way. We had people like Maxine Waters making incendiary statements, which were probably heard by the jury, which was not sequestered during the trial. And then, of course, Chauvin was found guilty on all three charges after about 14 hours of deliberation, which was very little. Now, I have a friend in the Twin Cities who I've been comparing notes with, and she is very diligent in following developments before, during, and after the trial. She's a young woman with a family, several young children, and a husband. And she reports to me periodically on what it's like in the ground there. By the way, she describes herself as a person of color or mixed race, and her husband is Caucasian. But she is living a life of fear now, in the Twin Cities as a resident there. And I believe that's her home turf. She has family there. Her husband's employed there. They just can't pick up and leave. But the statistics of the past year since the George Floyd death while in police custody last Memorial Day, the crime statistics are just through the roof. Carjackings up, I think, 300%. Shootings, murders, rapes, all kinds of crimes up. And the statistics are one thing, but when you can hear the accounts of a person who actually lives there and is trying to raise a family there, it's heartbreaking and fear and loathing inducing. Now, here's I just want to quote a little bit from an email that she sent me yesterday. She said, "Peter, I'm so furious. We had a petition on change.org asking Minnesota Governor Tim Walz to grant a full pardon for Derek Chauvin since his civil liberties have been severely violated. We were well on our way to 1,000 signatures, and I checked it today, and change.org deleted it. I'm so frustrated. Does Officer Chauvin have any civil rights? Does anyone have any rights anymore? This whole case is so corrupt and evil. I feel like we are entering a new dark age. Why won't anyone cherish what the founding fathers and our veterans' ancestors fought so hard for? Why is everyone throwing everything away?" End quote. Well, that's very, very well stated. And I will be continuing to report on what she shares with me and what happens to Derek Chauvin. But it's a really sad state of affairs. Now, moving on to some other items in the news currently. Yesterday evening, that is Monday the 3rd of May, we had, I guess, the surprising news that Bill and Melinda Gates, who have their Gates Foundation, funded largely but not exclusively by their billions as the fourth richest couple, or in the case of Bill Gates, person in the world, they are getting divorced. They announced their divorce after 27 years of marriage, and they've actually been together even longer than that. So their marriage is kaput. And immediately there's speculation on, well, what does this mean for the Gates Foundation, which, many people identify Bill Gates with what he's been doing in his post-Microsoft career as right up there with somebody like Dr. Doom, Anthony Fauci, as having been a really negative influence on healthcare and other policies on the planet. You know, not only a climate change fanatic, but a vaccine fanatic, and someone who has all this influence just because he's one of the richest men in the world. So when I looked at a photo of the couple that Drudge Report had at the top headlining the story, and I hadn't really paid much attention to what each of them looked like lately, and I have to say that looking at Melinda Gates, what her recent portrait brought to mind was Caitlyn Jenner, the former Bruce Jenner, the transgender individual who is now running for governor of California, assuming that Gavin Newsom is booted out when he faces a recall election this November. But I don't know, that's just my opinion looking at the photo, and can see what you think about that. By the way, there was before we finish with the Derek Chauvin story, my contact in the Twin Cities sent me a link to this story, which was published, I believe, yesterday or a few days before that. There's an individual, one of the jurors who decided the fate of Derek Chauvin in the trial, who, of course, voted him guilty on all counts. This individual, who is black, allegedly lied in the pretrial voir dire, it's called, where the potential jurors are interviewed to see if they have any inherent bias one way or the other. And he denied that he'd ever taken a stand publicly in favor of Black Lives Matter or whatever. Well, it turns out that according to, I believe, BigLeaguePolitics.com and then the Washington Times followed up, this individual was photographed at a Black Lives Rally Matter in Washington, D.C. last August 28th. So there are allegations that he lied to get on the jury. And the Big League Politics article goes much further into it. And this individual allegedly on social media, I believe, said things like it's the responsibility of people of color who feel this way like he does, you know, prejudging someone like Derek Chauvin, police officer, former police officer, that they get themselves on juries, doing whatever it takes to get on a jury so that they can work their wokeness in the jury system. I mean, this is unbelievable. And Drudge Report was highlighting that story today. I'm glad to see it's getting some coverage there, but perhaps that will be a factor in the appeal that Derek Chauvin's lawyers plan to make to try to get his conviction in that case overturned. Here's another interesting story which broke on Fox News's special report program with Bret Baier yesterday. That is Monday, the 3rd of May. And it was titled, "Microwave Weapons Are Targeting U.S. Officials at Home and Abroad." That's the title of the article about this at foxnews.com. And the gist of it is that in Russia and also in China, the authoritarian fascistic governments, both of those countries, are using sophisticated microwave weapons to target U.S. Diplomats to basically damage their brains, seriously, physically. And they have to leave their posts. And, of course, going back years, there have been reports that the old Soviet Union, for example, used to aim microwave rays at the United States Embassy in Moscow, which caused similar or an earlier incarnation of deleterious impacts on some of the diplomats. And this also has been reported to be going on in Cuba, where we now, thanks to Obama, have diplomatic relations and an embassy and diplomats in Havana. The same thing there, that I think more than a score of U.S. diplomats in Havana have had to leave their posts because of this kind of damage to their bodies and specifically their brains. But it was the point of this Fox report was there is now additional scientific evidence confirming this. It's not just a suspicion. It's not just an anecdotal report. And there were one or more scientists interviewed in this report and in this article who pointed to that. So I would recommend that article, certainly. Now, an article that was also published yesterday, which I found something of great concern, was by Chris Steyerwalt, who was fired by Fox News earlier this year after his allegedly what they said was his incorrect call of the state of Arizona prematurely last November 3rd in their election coverage, even though Arizona allegedly went to Biden in the end. We shall see. We'll be talking about that, by the way, in the next hour with Diana West. She's deeply into researching everything that went on in the election 2020 and the aftermath. So we'll get into that. But this article by Steyerwalt was titled, "The Era of Big Government is Here." And here was the lead of this article. And I have to say it struck me because I reluctantly have had to conclude after following politics closely for over 57 years, including starting in 1964 when President Lyndon Baines Johnson was reelected by, well, it was elected by a landslide, the accidental president, on November 3rd, 1964, defeating the most conservative candidate ever to run for president, Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona. So Johnson won in a landslide. The Congress had a majority of Democrats that was filibuster-proof, and LBJ went on to almost outdo Franklin Delano Roosevelt for instituting a plethora of government programs, and he really rolled out the modern era of big government, things like Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, which began, in my opinion, the unraveling of principled individual health care in this country. But back to Steyerwalt's article yesterday, he wrote this: "The American conservative movement hit its lowest ebb in generations last week. Its success was so towering 25 years ago that Democratic President Bill Clinton embraced smaller government, free trade, welfare reform, and fiscal discipline." Only 25 years ago. "Conservatives' failure now is so abject that not only has a new Democratic president repudiated those concepts in his first address to Congress, but the Republican Party, that for decades made itself synonymous with the conservative movement, also increasingly rejects its core tenets. The tidal shift toward big, activist, progressive government that began even before the financial crisis of 2008 has washed over both parties and left conservatism lost at sea." End quote. Well, again, I am sorry to say that I have to appreciate, if not totally agree with what Steyerwalt is reporting there. And, you know, another thing to consider, President Trump, of course, has been largely off the map and silent, or largely silent, except for issuing a few statements from his office in Florida and appearing in a limited number of interviews, mostly on Fox News, most of them, actually all of them with one exception, by telephone. And the only exception was last month when President Trump appeared for an hour in a sit-down on-camera interview with Sean Hannity, recorded at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. That's the only time President Trump has been on camera since he left office on January 20th. And one reason he has been neutered in his ability to communicate easily with followers and independents and whoever else is that he's been banned from social media, which continues to concern me and actually boggle my mind that a president of the United States, with one mouse click of someone at Facebook and Twitter or Instagram, could be completely deleted. The entire record of President Trump's presidency, tens of thousands of tweets, Facebook postings, links, comments by millions of people, and he had 90 million followers on Twitter towards the end there, just gone overnight. And it's kind of like the equivalent, the technological equivalent of book burning almost, where you just completely banish thoughts, ideas, reporting, or a person you don't like. And that's it. That's the end. It's just incredible. I just want to comment briefly on this because about, you know, I do a lot of reporting on cable news, the news media, mainstream media, and about 3 years ago, the suspicious meme began to take hold. I suspected then, and I'm pretty certain now, that it was due to controlled opposition on the part of the deep state. It held that Fox News had gone left and should be avoided, if not ditched altogether, by conservatives. Now, it's ironic that Fox News was then, and is even more so now, the number one target of radical leftists. But this criticism of the channel from the right accelerated after the election and some calls about who won the election that conservatives didn't like. And people were advocating boycotting Fox News and, as I said, dumping it all together. Now, I argued then that no news outlet is perfect and that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, that Fox News was the only major competitive mainstream news outlet that had not become totally corrupt and captured by the left. And I wrote an article about this, one of about four, but the most recent one at American Thinker several months ago, and it was not well received by the audience there. In fact, I got more negative blowback as a result of that piece than anything else I had ever written for American Thinker, and a lot of it was ugly. But now the ratings are back. Fox is back on top, I think deservedly. And all you have to do is think about Tucker Carlson, Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Steve Hilton, Mark Levin, and others. They're an A-list of conservative contributors, and I stand by my reporting. That's the end of the first hour. Please stay tuned for hour number two with my guest, Diana West. This is Peter Barry Chalker sitting back very short about.
Reporting on what the mainstream media won't, you're listening to the Hagman & Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network.
Welcome to hour number two of the Hagman Report for today. It's Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. Once again, I'm Peter Barry Chalker, guest hosting today for Doug Hagman, who has laryngitis. And helping me to introduce this hour of the program is one of the two resident cats here, Biggie, who I believe is still ensconced on the chair behind me. People who remember me from back in the day here may recall that the two house cats, Biggie and Lulu, would often be visible in the background or sometimes the foreground when I was on. And they had their fans. And when I mentioned to several Twitter friends yesterday that I'd be guest hosting today, they said they hoped they'd get to see Lulu and Biggie. And what caught my attention today was a Reuters story. U.S. pet adoptions still strong as cats and dogs melt stress. And so it is. I can attest to that. Now, without further delay, I want to welcome my guest in this entire hour ahead, Diana West. Diana is one of our country's most valuable journalists and authors. Throughout her career, she has done groundbreaking work, not only reporting the news from a conservative point of view, but breaking new ground in her probing historical research and analysis. And two of her books especially are relevant now, American Betrayal and her most recent book, The Red Thread, These trace the profound influence of Marxism and communism on American politics and other institutions, and that certainly is a relevant point of view now. Now, today we're going to have the benefit of a conversation with Diana West during this hour about her latest reporting. So without further delay, Diana West, welcome again to the Hagman Report.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's wonderful to be with you.
Yes, absolutely. I think I recalled in the previous hour fondly the 2-hour-long interviews that we had a chance to do here on this platform in the fall of 2018, and I remember them fondly to this day, and I think they're still online, archived at YouTube, for anyone who wants to look for them. Now, before we get to the two areas that you wanted to focus on, where your recent work has really concentrated, the fact that you're a realist in reporting the Marxist influence in the United States, I just want to open with this general question, and then we'll get down into the details. Did you ever think we would find ourselves in a situation like we have now, 100 days into the Biden administration, where we're going, even to the left of someone like Bernie Sanders? I mean, did you find this surprising or maybe expected based on all the work that you've done leading up to this moment?
I know that's a general question, but it's a very good question. And I would say, honestly, no, in the sense that it is so hard to get to the point of realization that we are in this political end times, if you will. And I suppose that I thought it would always be ahead, that, and particularly after 2016, there seemed to be a sense that we could right the boat. So what we've seen is really the manifestation of that successful subversion that, had we not perhaps come close to riding the boat in 2016 with the election of President Trump, might have always stayed kind of hidden to us. We might have been kind of sleepwalking into this rather than jolted into it when you realize. The way I think of what happened to us between November 3rd and January 6th was essentially the American people were overthrown by the three subverted branches of government and the media. So it's been a rocky trip to where we are. And I didn't expect it to go quite this way. And then, kind of the concentric circle outside of our political change, the medical tyranny as well, never imagined that at all. So much for my prognostication, I suppose. But things are surprising and shocking.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the medical tyranny, because that's what I talked about at length in the first hour, and examining an article I wrote on that very topic. The racism brought into the medical industry now, which on top of the COVID-19 fear-inducing panic that has given incredible power to the medical industrial complex and big politics as a result, it's a full spectrum assault on what's left of our freedoms. But to focus explicitly now on election 2020, I know you've been following that very, very closely since November. So where do you want to start with that? I mean, it's been swept under the rug, obviously, and I think what's let us down most, maybe aside from the courts, is the news media, which has completely failed to investigate any of the obvious finagling that went on before, during, and after November 3rd. And without that, we've got really nothing. But what do you think we really need at this point, 6 months later, to be aware of in terms of what went down in the lead up to November 3rd, the election, and then afterwards what happened? I mean, what has your research turned up that's most important that we should be focused on at this point?
The most important thing to focus on at this point is what we know as free-thinking, sentient beings, which is everything the opposite of what we call the media, the news media, social media, tell us. And in many ways, I have essentially stopped being a news consumer as best I can, in the sense that I think the 24/7 psychological operations, the brainwashing that is going on, whether it's about the political world or the medical world, is really dangerous to our health, our physical health, and our mental health. And that is not hyperbole. I am serious. I am serious. But we know in our bones what we have witnessed. And that, to me, there is actually the heartening news to me, is that the understanding that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president is something that is widely known in this country, despite the 24/7 brainwashing that's been going on in the media from November 3rd forward, certainly. Well, of course, there was preparatory work going into the election, but certainly from November 3rd forward. And remember, Peter, that goes across the political spectrum of media.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a shocking thing to behold, to see the essential collaboration from right to left in the media on what was going on in terms of the fraud, the investigations of the fraud, the various legal cases, the what was happening to the lawyers, you know, the tremendous pressure, the doxing, what, you know, all the whole spectrum of events that we did get at least a sense of to understand, as polls continue to tell us, Rasmussen polls continue to tell us that something like 75% of Republicans know Joe Biden cheated to become president, but 30%, which isn't really that bad, of the country as a whole, of all the political parties as a whole, understand that fact too. And when you realize how we have been, we should have had it beaten out of us at this point, that is sort of, in a funny way, sort of an upside down way of looking at a positive resilience in the American people, I think, to date. But in terms of looking at events, the thing that I realized I could not do in this illegitimate Biden regime, because that's what I think it is, I could not play pundit in, for example, weekly commentary. I had a long-running weekly radio spot, for example, on Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio for many years. I told Frank Gaffney, you know, no, this was completely amicable. There was no rancor or anger or any sort of rupture. But I just said, I can't comment on this Biden thing as if it was normal. I can't talk about how far left so-and-so is or how totalitarian this policy is. It is so, we are past normalizing this kind of behavior. I think it's treason. I think everyone connected with this election is committing, or not this election, but this administration is committing treason. They are partaking of fraud. They are benefiting from fraud. And, you know, that goes all the way across our government, I'm sorry to say, when you look at the individual behavior from the executive branch as represented by Mike Pence on January 6th in the Congress as president of the Senate, the courts, the Congress itself in normalizing, codifying, ratifying the Electoral College results and omitting the alternate slates of electors from many states that should have been counted by law on January 6th, which would have left the Electoral College outcome in suspended animation at that point. We would have gone forward in various, there are various ways to go forward that were written out for us by our founders and legislature. So basically, don't stop believing what you know, which is that we are in a tyranny at this point, and we all know it. And the media pretends it's not so, and a lot of people want to get back to normal and pretend it's not so, and just tisk-tisk over this trillion and that trillion being wasted. But this is something else. We are in some other kind of era, and the more we stick with our understanding of that, the better for our sanity, I think, and the only way forward out of it, if it's possible, is, you know, has to come from the truth.
I want to touch on something you raised in the excellent comments you just made. And by the way, for those listening and not watching, I'm Peter Barry-Chalka, guest hosting the Hagman Report today. And my guest by video Skype is Diana West, the prolific author, journalist, and commentator. And you had a very original analysis there and what you just said about the need to detach from this crazy 24/7 never-ending news cycle. It's faster than the speed of light. And I feel the same way. I'm having a hard time detaching from it. But it seems like that also would include, since you mentioned no longer being part of Frank Gaffney's program, and of course he's a conservative, renowned. Does that mean that you're also distancing yourself from a range of reporting in even the conservative media? Because I just, as a footnote there, I have concerns about where a lot of the conservative media has gone. They're chasing clicks, chasing page views, and a publication that several years ago would take a 4,000-word article from me now wants to limit it to 1,200 or 1,500 words max. That's just one small example. But please, if you could just expand a little on that, because I think that's a very original comment you've just made in my understanding of what we're – this sea of information and misinformation that we're swimming in and trying to make sense out of.
Yes, I would say yes. I would say that to understand kind of where I am in my career, you could say it's a bit suspended at the moment. I am trying to figure out what next in this period. You know, what can one do? What can one say? What can one report in a time where, you know, our right to self-determination has been seized? I truly believe that. I believe that we were overthrown as a people by our three branches of government with the collusion of the media, or maybe at the direction of the media. I don't know who's in charge. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's in charge of our country, by the way, because you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are clearly puppets of something else, something unknown to us, which is also terrifying. But in terms of trying to understand what more can we say, because if you believe that telling the truth, reporting as best you can, trying to uncover and unravel fake news and fake history had a consequence on November 3rd, which I believe it did. I believe President Trump was reelected. I believe that's the triumph of political argument, the triumph of exposure, the triumph of exposing Russia collusion, the hoax against the president. That worked. And yet something went wrong because all the mechanisms of power were flipped against us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's against him, of course, against President Trump, but he's just the man we voted for. We, the people, lost our voice. So as a journalist, as an author, you know, what else is there to do at that point? So I'm kind of working through that. I would say looking to the past, since my book American Betrayal came out in 2013, which was very controversial, you and I have talked about it a bit before. Mm-hmm. I have sort of gone through a period, a long period of what we now call cancellation, and that would include on the right. You know, the ideas embodied in that book were so controversial that there were many conservative sites and websites that became quite hostile to me. And, you know, that has just kind of continued into this period where I now find myself, again, kind of in suspended animation, wondering what else there is to try to unravel, to try to inform Americans about, learn for myself. And what I really come to at this point is also trying to make sense of this lawless period, which again almost becomes a smaller circle inside this larger medical tyranny, which is tied into the larger global reset, the reset that has been discussed at length, not enough, but at length, in terms of breaking national will, national destiny, economies, and coordinating, collectivizing all under the aegis of these elites. It now really seems to verge into all kinds of population control, reduction, perhaps. I mean, there are all kinds of crazy things going on in the world, and we see this with the vaccine program that's been rolled out on us. And you know, it's almost becoming I feel like we're almost all of us right now in a struggle for our own autonomy, let alone our right to self-determination as a political body. Now we're into a more or less individual struggle for self-determination as individual bodies, as bodies, as human beings, as spirits. And so it's a very dire time. And the right-wing media, the media on the right side of the spectrum, what we identify as right, is terrible. It's just as bad as the left. And the strange thing that's happened to me in right now, I have been delving quite deeply into what's going on with COVID vaccines and all of that, the COVID passports and the that whole thing, which combines medical and political. And I will say that some of my go-to sites at this point are on the left. And it's very interesting. I would think of Children's Defense. Robert Kennedy Jr.'s website is invaluable. I don't know what I would do without it at this point in terms of following the vaccine adverse events, discussing, you know, different, rounding up different news. There are certain blogs, the COVID blog. There's a very interesting essay site and interview site called Off Guardian. They do tremendous work on this subject, and I know they all started, or many of them started, I don't really know what they identify at this point, but I sort of identify the website with the left, and that's where I'm finding interesting personal essays, interesting reporting, contrary wisdom reporting, you know, interviews with the doctors and scientists who are trying to bring a different point of view to all of
true
this.
True facts-based medicine and science. Can I just jump in for a second? You mentioned Children's Health Defense, RFK Jr.'s 501c3 organization. I've interviewed the president and chief counsel, Mary Holland, of that group. She's the key person there in addition to RFK Jr. I interviewed her twice for an hour each time when I guest hosted John B. Wells's Saturday night nationally syndicated terrestrial radio show, Arc Midnight. And the first time I interviewed her was in March. And when I had an opportunity 5 weeks later to guest host the show again, and I did a quick review of who's out there, who might be good to invite. And I thought, there's nobody better than Mary Holland. And exactly, she and her associates there are coming from the progressive liberal left, liberal as opposed to radical. And there is nothing that she said when I interviewed her on both of those occasions that I disagreed with. And I felt actually a sense of optimism because of that unifying thing that she and that organization are doing. And when they put out videos and articles, they include people who are on the right as well. So it's extremely encouraging. And I thought maybe, just maybe, I hope to God that the COVID-19 pandemic as an unexpected impact will help to unify us. But before we get, I want to focus on COVID-19 explicitly, but I just want to ask you one or two more things about the election before we wrap that up. Sure. I happened to read, as I think you did as well, or consult Patrick Byrne's extensive series, I believe it was 6 parts online now as a book, How Donald J. Trump Lost the White House. He, of course, the founder and the former CEO of Overstock. After he left that, he volunteered to assist those in the circle around President Trump who were trying to bring some light into what happened on the election and maybe get it right. And after January 6th, he pretty much deconstructed it in this very interesting series of articles, which are available free online. And I wonder what you thought of his analysis in terms of your own research of what went wrong, why we didn't hit pay dirt, so to speak, with the aftermath of the election, why the truth couldn't get out and something be done about it.
Right. Well, his essays are quite fascinating because he ended up, he was no friend of President Trump's. He didn't even vote for him, but he ended up associating with Sidney Powell and some other people, General Flynn, and they ended up having some really important meetings with President Trump, trying to figure out how to do exactly that, get it right. I don't know if it was too late at that point. It was certainly such a long time coming. I mean, this coup, I see the election and its aftermath as simply another cycle in the effort to unseat President Trump, to again overturn the American people going back to 2016, with, you know, we watched so many different iterations of that same attempted coup, rolling coup d'etat. This is what it was. They finally got it in that period of November 3rd to January 6th. I think that, you know, up until January 6th, there was a shot. I think that the perfidy of Mike Pence is something that has not been unpacked enough. This mm-hmm. is something that I will actually send you a link in case you would like to use it. I was able to write about what Mike Pence did on January 6th, which was immediately deflected in the protests, the so-called armed insurrection, which was neither an armed, which was not armed and was not an insurrection, but the mm-hmm. protests became the marvelous, bright, shiny thing to ever take our eyes off of what truly went down on January 6th when Mike Pence was presiding and became what I call Benedict Pence. But in terms of why things could not go right, President Trump, you know, never helped himself. He continually hired the wrong man. And, you know, the questions of how he could so consistently be wrong so often in terms of the people around him is, you know, one of the enduring mysteries of his presidency. William Barr was one of his biggest mistakes. Vice President Pence was one of his biggest mistakes. Christopher Wray, one of his biggest mistakes. That's hard to say three times.
Fauci?
Yeah, well, Fauci was the massive disaster in terms of the coronavirus, mm-hmm. and that was a vector of Mike Pence, you know, coming into the White House. Mm-hmm. I feel like President Trump walked right into the trap of the whole corona lockdown, probably in order to, you know, he wanted to open the country. He wanted to treat it like the flu. He wanted to have 15 days and be back open by Easter of 2020, if you recall. I'm sure you do. You wrote so well about that whole period. It was all blended together in this gigantic effort to destroy our election, to change the rules, to ensure that there would be all these opportunities for fraud with the various mail-in balloting and the rule changes on the postmarks. And I mean, it's such a long, complicated story that also brought in massive amounts of money from Mark Zuckerberg's organization to essentially privatize the election in so many of these key states, key swing states, where the fraud really went down hot and heavy. And why we couldn't overturn it? Well, you know what? We were overturning it. And I think that the coup plotters were in terror when we got to January 6th, and we actually had a situation where there were enough senators and congressmen who were going to be challenging results. And really, anything could have happened at that point. Anything could have happened in terms of getting to a point where the alternate Trump electors, and I believe in as many as seven states, could well have been thrown into the mix of counted electoral college votes, along with the votes that were sent forward by the different states officially by their governors. If you came to an inconclusive total on January 6th, there were many different ways forward, either going back to the states themselves to have the legislatures resolve the contested, the dueling electors slates, mm-hmm. which is what was underway. And there were states that were on the verge of flipping in their legislatures, or there were things to be done in terms of how the vote could be counted in the House of Representatives. There's all manner of a roadmap that is written for us in our founding documents and other papers that had to be stopped. And I do believe that the protest itself was used as a manufactured crisis, was commandeered as a manufactured crisis in order to just move us forward to obliterate the due process that was underway as of the morning of January 6th and to just take us into this militarized period, this fake coup, or the Biden forces were trying to project this as a fake coup against this legitimate election. So the whole thing became this exercise in something like the Reichstag fire from the mm-hmm. 1930s, when in Nazi Germany there was this event that was used by Adolf Hitler, a fire in their parliament, to essentially obliterate the political opposition. That is exactly what happened here. Mm-hmm. And we are still dealing with the consequences of that. There are somewhere around three or four dozen Trump protesters who have been in solitary confinement and are literally being tortured, brutalized for sure, in DC jail to this day for months. I mean, this is something like a human rights crisis, the likes of which we would look back, say we read about it in the Soviet Union in the 1970s. There would be all kinds of human rights organizations trying to throw light on this terrible brutalization of human beings, you know, persecuted for their political beliefs. That's what's going on under the auspices of our Justice Department. So we are in this extremely unique period of crisis. And the more people try to pretend everything is normal and just think, oh, wait till 2022 or 2024, you know, the more we are normalizing this theft of our nation.
Yeah, I just wanted to add this, and I couldn't agree with you more on the analysis you just offered. The election itself last year, November 3rd, notwithstanding, I think it was unfair from the outset, from the day of the inauguration in 2017, when President Trump was inaugurated, and even before that, and certainly after that, for 4 years, he was treated like no other political figure in American history in terms of the 90 to 95% disapproval and lies that were hurled on him, the impeachment effort, which was fake, the post-presidency impeachment effort, the whole Russia collusion thing. It just boggles the mind of how much he had to put up with. And it also seems to me that, not having researched it nearly as thoroughly as you have, obviously, but from reading Patrick Byrne's reporting and other reports, that President Trump was extremely isolated, if not before the election, certainly afterwards. You know, the whole deep administrative state was against him. He had enemies within the White House at various levels working against him, leaking, etc. And he really, this is not to absolve him from maybe poor managerial decisions at several key points, but he was desperate. And this is what I took from, part of what I took from Patrick Byrne's reporting in his articles, how Donald J. Trump lost the White House. And it's just really sad. And we did have a shot there in 2016. I believe it was almost divine intervention that prevented the ascent to power of Hillary Clinton. But now, of course, we have probably Obama 2.0 or whatever. I agree with you. It's not Joe Biden or Kamala Harris running the show. But I'm speechless.
No, there's the personal tragedy of President Trump, which is the national tragedy of the American people. And you're correct to remind us all of what it was like to be Donald Trump, waking up every day under assault from every direction.
Yeah.
You know, it's really quite biblical in so many ways in terms of the ardors that he had to undergo every single day. Yeah. And yet he was able to accomplish so much. I mean, it's really, quite extraordinary that he didn't just curl up in a fetal position and go back, you know, to the golf course where he could enjoy a happy life, as, you know, he did before this. So it's truly something we've all lived through. I think it's psychologically battered us all. It certainly, I'm sure, had to have psychologically battered the man himself. He is, after all, a human being. Mm-hmm. And you know, these same forces that tried and tried and tried and finally succeeded in subverting our system are now in charge of our political and medical and
legal system.
Cultural and legal destiny. I mean, we are in a terrible bind. There, of course, are more of us than there are of them. But, you know, that always is not, that's often not a real game changer, as we find out in history, when authoritarians, when dictators, when totalitarian monsters take hold. It doesn't matter that they're outnumbered by the people that they are terrorizing. It's something changes in the makeup of the people under these kinds of terror regimes. And, you know, that's kind of how I'm feeling lately. I mean, you don't feel free anymore. You don't feel you have autonomy. You don't feel you have legal rights. We've seen so much trampling of our constitutional rights. I mean, look at the raid on Rudy Giuliani's home and office by the FBI.
Outrageous.
Just last week for these completely trumped up charges, things that could easily have been taken care of with a lawyer meeting, with an invitation to talk, with a discussion, to figure out what sort of evidence. I mean, this is, as Rudy pointed out himself, he said, this is evidence I've been holding for years. And, the whole premise of a raid is that the person is going to flee or destroy evidence. And this is ridiculous. But the trampling of rights, the politicization of our legal mechanism. I mean, it goes back. We watched it during the Trump administration. We watched the politicization of justice, the similar raids on people like Paul Manafort and Roger Stone. We watched this same kind of punitive power being used, and we watched, of course, the weaponization of our intelligence agencies against the president himself and his team, the people who were committing democracy by actually joining a presidential campaign and campaigning and then winning. I mean, this is how rotten these people are, how desperate they are, how they play, no holds barred, ends justify the means. Who is pushing this? Who benefits from this? We see, of course, the beneficiaries here in this country, but there are beneficiaries in other countries as well. Our foreign adversaries benefit. And then when we find the tie-ins between the Biden crime family and, for example, the Chinese government, with the nexus being in Hunter Biden, who's in business with the Chinese government, Chinese banking system, you have to say, well, who is really calling the shots? Who is directing this administration to essentially destroy our country, to open it up, to bankrupt it, to penalize our people, to destroy our justice system? Well, isn't it interesting how that benefits Moscow and Beijing? I mean, how is that not something that we discuss and notice and put together?
Speaking of traitors.
Yeah.
They're traitors.
And yet no, of course the Justice Department does nothing. The FBI did nothing about
it. The media does nothing.
CIA, yeah, all of it. It just goes on and on. And then meanwhile, you see political, not even dissent, just political discussion, political debate shut down in this country. Medical debate shut down in this country. You see the censorship of big media and news media that has sent information gathering to being a very exotic and difficult pursuit. It's very difficult if someone really wants to research, for example, should I get the vaccine? It's very difficult to use conventional means to actually get any information that is not propaganda.
Yeah. What Including country? From the medical journals, which have been totally corrupted. They have been for a long time, but now they're actually espousing critical race theory and saying that racism is the most important medical issue facing us today. I did quite a bit in the first hour on that. It's just unbelievably. My concern now is that if President Trump tries to regain and reassert his leadership of his rather large MAGA constituency, that there are efforts afoot to take him and his family down. We have Cyrus Vance in New York with 10 million pages or whatever of President Trump's tax returns and other financial documents. We have the New York Attorney General Letitia James on his case. And they want to do to him what they've started to do to Rudy Giuliani. And it's I think they're really going for broke now, and they are not going to stop until they completely wipe out the leadership of Make America Great Again. And that means President Donald Trump.
Right, right. And in the younger generation, Matt Gaetz, who's been, completely a victim of a whispering, slandering campaign without evidence. I mean, this is...
And compare him to what's on Hunter Biden's laptop.
Right, exactly. I mean, there is no single standard. There is no fact pursuit.
No,
this
parody
is all
at
weaponized
all.
Propaganda. Right. No, it's incredible to be witnessing this and feeling quite powerless about it. There are more of us than there are of them. You know, that has to be something we understand, that President Trump was reelected by voters in this country, and then the mechanisms of power took it away. Mm-hmm. And again, I just can't underscore enough the importance of sticking to our understanding of these events. This was not a legitimate presidency. We do not have a legitimate president. People abroad seem to have absolutely no clue about this whatsoever, because they have no resources to figure this out. And I've been struck by that in doing some talking and a little bit of interviewing abroad, and just no concept of what really went down here. But it's a lot to take in terms of the Supreme Court and the Congress and the executive branch and the media and the conservatives and the liberals. I mean, it's an incredible, talk about a conspiracy so immense. I mean, it's an incredible conspiracy. That's what it is. It has to be, to suppress information, to suppress court, you know, opportunities to present evidence in court, because that's essentially what all the courts did that would not hear the various mm-hmm. Trump cases. They did not want that evidence to enter into the record. Same in the Congress with the electoral certification. And then on top of that, you get this creation, this disinformation about what went down on January 6th, who these Americans are with no arrest records, you know, no arms, no intentions of overthrowing the government. And yet the government itself is now devoting more resources to this investigation, they say, than to any previous investigation. And that would include terrorism, mafia, you know,
all the riots and insurrection, the true insurrection, right, all last summer. Antifa, Black Lives Matter, 200 cities affected, billions of dollars worth of damage. It goes on to this day in cities like Portland, Oregon, and nothing. No arrests, no investigations, nada.
And that's why when you look at the government, it isn't so much that you complain that they're not doing their job. You have to understand that they are doing their job. The American people are in the crosshairs, yes, of the government. And that is quite something to understand and to really internalize. But it does start with understanding that the Biden-Harris is a regime, not a presidency. And then you can understand all of these executive orders, I mean, dictatorial orders, et cetera, and these programs and these actions and then a lack of actions that essentially are a war on America. It's like everyone who enters that administration is essentially anti-American politically.
Mm-hmm. They make it so obvious, the statement by the new United States representative at the United Nations criticizing our country, saying it's racist and evil in effect. It just boggles the mind. Hey, in the remaining time left, let's move on to the COVID-19 issue, the pandemic or the plandemic, as some of us call it. Can I get your opinion on this? Do you think that it was a bioweapon or an accidental release from the Wuhan virology lab?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, of course. It certainly has been acted upon as a bioweapon. If it had been an accidental release, it has been capitalized on and used to destroy first the world economy, the American election, our free market, our business people, our school. I mean, it's been used exactly as a bioweapon. Almost, you know, the answer is something I don't have obviously access to. I think that the people who are behind the measures, the lockdown measures, the reset, were planning for such an event, whether this was actually, you know, in concert with that event. It doesn't almost matter, because the plans were already written. The notion you could lock down a free country, that you could put people, it's lockdown is a euphemism. This is house arrest. Healthy people being put under house arrest is something that these Rockefeller Foundation, different government planning commissions and departments have been working on for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So this was their opportunity, and they went for it, and it the effect is the same. I go back and forth, you know, I watch some doctors and scientists who talk about the bioweapon and the engineered virus. And then I watch other doctors and scientists who who are questioning, you know, germ theory in general. I find both of them much to be admired and respected and learned from in both sides. Mm-hmm. And what I sometimes come down to myself is it could be both. It could be something released from the lab and this kind of the fraud of you know, the virus mania that gets attached to whatever it was that may well have been engineered through the whole genetic manipulations and so on that we've learned so much about in this period. So that's kind of where I come down on that. It's I'm dealing sort of like with Islam. I deal with the effects of it, and I'm dealing with the effects of this thing we call SARS-CoV-2. And it certainly is maybe seen as a vector against all we hold dear, just as Sharia law is. So it's almost, you know, you deal with what's there, and that is how it manifests itself.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing I've been covering for many years, of course, in my analysis of the politics of medicine, and that's why I was familiar with Anthony Fauci. I first reported on him in the mid-1980s, yeah. Thanks to the HIV-AIDS war on. And he, more than anyone, helped to engineer the explosive growth of this humongous medical industrial complex at the National Institutes of Health, which has now spent on AIDS about two-thirds of $1 trillion on research into HIV-AIDS. And the death toll from AIDS, according to the government, is about 600,000 or 700,000 people in 40 years. Well, we lose that many to cancer every year. But yeah. AIDS spending has rivaled cancer spending. And interestingly, this footnote, in the first decade of this new century, HIV-AIDS was still a big deal, and as it probably is today, although it's been dwarfed by COVID. But there was still tons of grants given out by the government here and other governments and the World Health Organization, et cetera, for HIV-AIDS research. And every year there was a big international HIV-AIDS conference. And in the around 2004, 2005, it was the party line of this group of medical bureaucrats to try to scare everyone on the planet about HIV-AIDS, which, and we know how that was shared by so-called unsafe sexual practices or injecting illegal drugs for the most part. And yet they were trying to scare people and say everybody on the planet should have a test for HIV-AIDS and be treated, even if they are supposedly deemed at risk for AIDS, or but they haven't developed symptoms yet, be given powerful antiretroviral drugs. Now, that didn't quite work. It didn't pan out because they couldn't sell that one. But I think in many ways the same blueprint was used here with COVID-19. They finally got something that could, with their manipulation of the media, scare everyone to death. And here we are 1 year later with you know, a large, 30% of the American people supposedly fully vaccinated now with the various COVID-19 vaccines. And as you said, too, it's an excellent point you raised that things aren't mutually exclusive. You have experts, researchers, doctors on the one hand saying this, on the other hand saying that. They could both have a piece of the truth, but we're behind the eight ball in trying to get to the truth because of the censorship, the political incorrectness, and the canceling that's going on with anything that you say that runs against the government party line of the moment. It's a series of daunting challenges we face that I don't think I wasn't around in the early days of this country, but I can't believe it's ever been this screwed up where just even getting information is now an insurrectionist act, according to the powers that be.
It's so true. And I think another thing people need to really focus on is trying to get information to make comparisons. We can't learn or make value judgments without being able to compare COVID deaths to other deaths, or let's say vaccine mm-hmm. deaths, to other deaths. And yes. Dr. Peter McCullough is someone who brought out some really fascinating and important data recently in an interview with Alex Newman, I believe it was. And he said that when we go back to the swine flu epidemic in the mid-1970s, you had something like 55 million Americans vaccinated by 1976 or so. You had about 500 instances of Guillain-Barré syndrome, the very terrible paralysis mm-hmm. that were connecting, you know, associating with the swine flu vaccine. You had 25 deaths associated with the same vaccine program in a matter of its first months. What did the government do? It halted the vaccine program.
Mm-hmm.
You compare that to what we've seen in the same, you know, few months where we've had something like, I've seen numbers when he was talking, he was saying, it was a few weeks ago, he was saying we had 77 million people fully vaccinated in America. Mm-hmm. You had at that point something like 2,400 deaths. And when you compare that to the swine flu era, the recklessness of the government in going forward with this program, looking at what he was calling, he used the word unprecedented numbers of death from a vaccine. He also compared it to your typical flu year. He said it was about 195 million people would get a flu shot every year. You had 20 to 30 deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you start weighing those numbers and you see these mounting deaths, and of course, these are CDC figures, mm-hmm. and CDC tallies are notoriously slow and also underestimating because very many things never even get entered into this vaccine adverse event reporting system. It is a staggering thing to be beholding that the government, the media, everyone is giving you a line of propaganda that this experimental gene injection is safe. It is risky. It is untested. And we already have numbers that in a normal world in our country before it was taken over would have caused responsible leaders to call it out and say, we need to put this back on the drawing board and stop vaccinating people, especially women, pregnant women and
children now.
Children, which is utterly mad because children are at no risk, even in their own terms, of whatever it is that, you know, coronavirus COVID-19 is or is not. They, even in their own terms, it does not affect children. So the idea of vaccinating them, or with this shot of really risky stuff, is not just insane. You start thinking of Nazi programs,
yes.
Nazi medical interventions. What is this really about? It's clearly not about our health. It's clearly not about our well-being. And then that's where you sort of have to start opening up and really digging deep and trying to understand these people. But you also have to start understanding yourself and say, no, I don't want that. I have informed consent and right of consent, and I don't want that, if that's where you conclude. And they're trying to take that away from us. It's like they took away our right of self-determination. Now they're trying to take away our right of informed consent. And we have to start weighing these kinds of numbers, listening to these doctors who are really trying hard to bring us an alternate point of view so we can make these completely personal decisions. This has nothing to do with anyone but your own self and your own family. And they want to take that away from us. And,
right.
you know, that's sort of where it really gets again. You know, we have the national problems, but we also have our personal problems. National sovereignty, personal sovereignty. There's nothing after that. You know, that's kind of where we are.
Right. Well, for many years, I reported on innovative alternative therapies for prevention and treatment of illnesses that were apart from the allopathic medical mainstream. And at the time, it was very popular to support freedom of choice in healthcare, because without freedom, you have no choice, and without choice, you have no freedom. And that's exactly on display now with this COVID-19 madness, the pressure to take the vaccine. And let's touch on immunity passports, because I've been reporting on that and very concerned about that. And it looks like even if Joe Biden claims he's not going to insist on it, although he hasn't closed the door on demanding it from the military yet, but now it's moved into the private sector, the corporate sector, insisting on people having proof, demonstrable, verifiable proof that they've taken the complete range of the vaccines before they would be allowed to shop, dine, go to concerts or whatever. This is, true fascism, in my opinion, where it's a collusion of the corporate big business sector and an authoritarian government. And I'm not sure how we're going to fight that one.
Well, we have to reject this regime of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, I'm waiting for a case to be filed that I understand it, because this COVID-19, the COVID-19 injections are authorized under something called the Emergency Use Authorization. Their use cannot be compelled by the government, by private sectors, that there is a legal protection here, given the fact that it's an experimental, it is by label, by official right. understanding, something experimental.
And it's unproven. It's completely unproven.
And it has not been designated an approved treatment. Mm-hmm. It is all experimental. And so that is where I don't understand. You know, the law seems very clear to me that you cannot be coerced into taking it, and yet we are seeing this encroachment on our autonomy as airlines discuss, you know, this kind of, you know, the vaccine for travel. Certain countries are discussed. I mean, foreign countries can do whatever they want.
But and they are.
And they are. And we're seeing colleges make announcements about it. We're seeing people start to internalize the notion that once people are vaccinated, they can gather. It's terribly frightening, and it is an ultimate erosion of liberty. Liberty cannot exist when all your data belongs to the government, is in a cloud. And I will tell you that in my readings recently, I came across the beginning. I love finding the beginning of these things. But in this country, about in the mid to early 1963, 64, something like that, there was in the Johnson year, so it must have been 64, 65, there was a creation of a federal database. And it was the beginning of a federal database that would have all kinds of personal information. And, of course, it was with the rise of computers that such things became, you know, possible or even conceivable. And there was a congressman at the time who was extremely exercised about it and talking about how once this sort of data, even about your credit and things like that, could be centralized, you were losing your liberty. And, you know, this is something that we grew up with, assuming mm-hmm. that banks would have our credit information. I mean, this never should have happened either. I mean, this kind of centralization of our personal private information never should have gone forward, but it's been that long. It's been a half century almost since that creation of that thing under the Johnson administration. So that's kind of the length of this trajectory, which means people have been thinking about this kind of control, amassing this kind of control over the American people for that long, which is depressing. But it's now so close to realization, if it isn't even past realization. I know they have so much on us all, but now they really want to get us with this, you know, this vaccine. And then what's the next thing? Well, the head of the World Economic Forum is very excited about the idea of microchipping our brains.
Right.
This really doesn't stop
Well, they've got the information, and now they're going to use it. You know, it was in 2007, among the first articles I wrote for American Thinker in the summer of 2007, I wrote two long pieces about the imposition, the mandating of electronic medical records throughout this country, that individual physician offices, hospitals, had to get online with the federal government and move all of their previous paper records, or however they were kept, into a nationally accessible electronic database. And there were some voices calling out then about this was a Faustian bargain. And now, a decade and a half later, this has been turbocharged. It's on steroids now with COVID-19. It's another thing COVID-19 has achieved, where people are enough people probably are going to willingly approve of even more of their data being held and centralized, because it will allow them to go back to a, quote, new normal. But I wonder if that new normal is even on the drawing boards. Now, the New York Times had an article several days ago about how experts are now saying we may not achieve so-called herd immunity. So, Dinah, before we end this segment, why don't you let our listeners and viewers know the best way they can follow your work? What's the most easily accessible way to keep up with what you are doing?
My website, thank you for asking. My website is dianawest.net. It is independent. It will not disappear, as far as I know. And I have moved over. I was among the those honored by being suspended permanently by Twitter, which I'm very proud of. I was wondering what was the problem. Took them too long, but I was suspended by Twitter, and I'm now on Gab, which is working great. I recommend it. I am at Real Diana West. And I also started a Patreon channel. It's a small channel, and I get on and vent once or twice a week about various things that we've been talking about here. So those are the three places to find my current work. And you can find links to all of my books, which are also audiobooks. It's the summer driving season, I hope, coming up. So there are also audiobooks. You can find those at my website as well.
Great. Well, I really appreciate your work, and I always appreciated your Twitter. I'm sorry that it's gone. I can understand that it's time to move on, but I'm sorry that your entire archive on Twitter, just like President Trump's, has now disappeared. I guess you can find some of it at archive.org, but it's not the same. So you mentioned at the outset that you were kind of in sort of a mode of retrenching from active journalism, but it sounds like you're still incredibly active. And I hope that the people listening to and watching this were taking notes, because I can't think of a more incisive, clear, and well-informed discussion on your part of the issues we've been talking about here. So thank you again for coming on. And if you could take I'll give you a closing minute here, if you can keep it to that, of just closing comments or anything you want to wrap this up with a bow.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for having this conversation, because as I'm sure your viewers know, these kinds of conversations are very hard to have. The Hagman Report is a good place to have them. But, you know, it's very important that we keep talking to each other and talking to our family members and trying to keep everybody just together, because these are tough, tough times for our country and for our families.
Diana West, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm very, very impressed, but I expected to be, but I'm even more impressed. So, bravo, and I just fantastic, fantastic analysis and commentary and reporting on your part. So, God bless you, and be looking forward to networking with you again, hopefully in the not too distant future.
Oh, me as well. God bless you too.
Thank you. Now, we're closing in on the end of today's Hagman Report for Tuesday, May 4th, 2021, with your guest host tonight, Peter Barry Chalka. But I'm not quite finished. God willing, I will be back tomorrow to guest host the Hagman Report again on Wednesday, May 5th, 2021, same time, same channels. And that will give Doug Hagman another day off so he can rest up and recover from his laryngitis, which is the reason that he was not here today. And I want to thank again my guest for this hour, Diana West. I'm just sitting here enthralled by her commentary and really, quite frankly, the brilliance of her her work. It's just outstanding. And she had a role on CNN in the first decade of this century. She appeared regularly on Lou Dobbs's program when he was on CNN. And clearly someone like Diana West, or Diana West, should be on the big media so we can really, everyone can hear what she has to say. Now, in closing, I believe in the power of prayer. I've documented it in my work as a journalist covering innovative medical care. So if you want to see Doug Hagman back here on Thursday, say a prayer for him. And while you're at it, please say a prayer for me and for my protection from the evildoers that I'm reporting on. And last but not least, I hope you will join me in saying many prayers for the survival and the future of our country. Pray like your lives depended on it, because they do. I'd also like to thank Tech Eric for his expert technical direction and engineering of the program today. And also thank my friend Doug Hagman for reaching out and asking me to guest host and giving me this opportunity. And again, you can find me and communicate with me if you wish by going to my one-page information website, non-commercial, at peter.media. That's P-E-T-E-R dot M-E-D-I-A. If you simply put that into your browser window or your phone window, since most people are accessing websites on their phone now, it will get you there. That has links to 300 of my articles in American Thinker that can be read for free, a biography, an email address, and my Twitter account, which I use as a table of contents. So, until tomorrow at this time, God bless you, and God bless America. And now, good night.